Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Few papers in the regenerative agriculture space have been shared more than the investment case for ecological agriculture written by Paul McMahon, the co-founder of SLM Partners in 2016. I've shared it countless times, learned a lot from it, from the simple investment terms describing why it makes so much sense to put money to work in real regen ag. Now it's been updated, or even better, completely rewritten, with a lot more science and a lot more experience from the field. Join me in a conversation with one of the most experienced regen farm investors out there when we explore the modules of our recent video course on why we need to change agriculture and the food system urgently and why the time is now to do it. And yes, we talk about yields, and yes, we talk about, more importantly, profits and the regenerative edge, which is real. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the Planet Mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Today, a very special episode. This is part of the series of interviews where we unpack our video course, which we relaunched recently. I'm just delighted to have Paul McMahon back on the show, because it would have been impossible to record the first few urgency modules where we talk about why we should act now and fundamentally change agriculture and food, and why we can act now. It would have been impossible without the white paper he wrote in 2016 and now recently rewrote. We interviewed him first in November 2016. It was the third interview ever on the podcast. And then he came back in November 2021, and I'm very happy in February 2024 to have him back just after the new white paper has been launched by SLM, which of course we'll link below. So I'm very happy to have you back here, Paul. Welcome. Third time is a charm.
Thank you, Ken. Great to be back again.
And I mean, you just come off a launch of a white paper. It's being shared a lot online. I think you had, I don't know, more than 250 people on a webinar to launch it. And that has changed, I think, quite dramatically compared to 2016. Do you remember the launch of the first white paper?
Yeah, it was very much what you call a stealth launch, a soft launch. I think back then, no one was really talking about regenerative agriculture. The term barely existed. I saw some very small circles.
And the white paper was called differently, like ecological agriculture, I think.
Well, we call it, the investment case for ecological farming. We did reference regenerative agriculture as well, within the first page. So I think they're interchangeable terms. But yeah, back then, no one's really talking about this outside of maybe a few very much pioneering farmer circles, really, very much on the ground innovators who were doing interesting things. But it hadn't really bubbled up, I would say, to the general food system level or even the certainly investor level yet. So that's how we wrote it, was to try to bring to light some of the exciting developments that were happening on the ground, highlight some of the problems with the conventional food system, but then point forward really to some solutions and exciting solutions, which are good for the planet, but could also be a good investment opportunity as well.
And to start with that piece of why we should act now to change the current food system or the conventional, a lot of people don't like the term, let's say the extractive, non-regenerative food system and agriculture system we have now, compared to the first white paper and now, I think, like, what has changed in terms of a lot of things got worse and a lot of things got more extreme, but like, have fundamental points changed in your in your view, as you wrote and updated the white paper and redid it, like that piece on the urgency, has that shifted?
I think there's yet more research, as there's an awareness of some of the issues around, you know, the current food systems. And we break it down to 5 major themes. So one is around soil health, you know, and the gradual degradation of soils around the world. I think that theme continues to be reinforced. To be honest, we see some exaggeration though of that as well. Like there's this quote from the FAO that we only have 60 years left of harvests. And, you know, I don't buy that. I think some of that is a little bit exaggerated. I think you lose credibility and people use.
Yeah, we looked for that. Actually, it's like difficult that. to find. There's a Reuters article, and then it's very difficult to find sort of a source for that. But I put it in the course, not because of that quote, because depends where you are. Context is probably a bit too much. But there's a sentence underneath, which then, since then has also disappeared. Like, luckily, I took a screenshot that it takes 10,000 years to build, I think, an inch of topsoil or something like that. And
yeah, which the fact that we that's all also true know is,
gives us a lot
we
of
also know it's wrong. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's a more interesting sentence, actually.
I think so there's a certain amount of environmental doom mongering going on, and I think we need to guard against that as well. So I think we do lose credibility with scientists and with farmers, you know, if we go too far. But at the same time, there's plenty of evidence showing that there are real issues with how our soil is being degraded and losing its biological life. You know, I think there was a great, actually, recent paper on this, I think published in Nature, where they showed that I think a third of the world's cropland would be degraded and useless within 200 years. So it's not 60 years, but still 200 years is still a blip in time, you know, in sort of human history. So there's definitely a real problem there. And we all know it needs to be addressed around soil health. I think the second theme, of course, we've probably got even more attention over the last 8 years is climate change and both the role of agriculture as a major source of emissions. So I think about 24% of human greenhouse gas emissions are associated with agriculture, either directly or indirectly. And so there's a huge urgency now, imperative, about reducing those emissions. But on the flip side, there's, I think, increasing recognition of the role agriculture can play in storing carbon in soils, in landscapes. I think that has really evolved and developed a lot since 2016. I think back then, IPCC and other kind of policy making for agriculture, forestry weren't really mentioned and they weren't in the picture. But I think since then, there's been real recognition that nature-based solutions, agricultural soils can play an important role in mitigating climate change. So that's been great to see. And there's just a lot more science to back it up. I think the third area around biodiversity, that's come on a lot. You know, I think, again, 8 years
ago. The last few years, Marley.
And even the last 3 years, I think it's been an explosion of interest in biodiversity, recognition of the problem of biodiversity loss, you know, this sixth mass extinction we're going through. And I think there's some research showing that agriculture is responsible for probably 85% of the biodiversity loss. But there's also, I think, a recognition that regenerative agriculture, the way we manage our landscapes, can help restore that biodiversity, conserve habitats, and help, you know, turn that around. So, yeah, biodiversity has really picked up steam, I'd say, you know, as an important topic. The fourth around water, I'd say that's probably been, you know, that's been well known, you know, both the issues with the use of freshwater resources for irrigation and over extraction, you know, certain water basins, but also the issue of nutrient runoff and dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, that's, I think, well known. I think we didn't find maybe a whole lot of new research, just more probably good examples of regenerative farming systems that can deliver the improvements we want. I think then the fifth area, though, I think, again, has come on quite a bit, is the recognition of the poor quality of a lot of our food today, you know, the nutritional dumbing down of our foods over the past 50 to 80 years, and the lack of minerals and vitamins and other micronutrients, the impacts that can have on human health. And that's partly because of plant breeding and the way we grow our animals. But it's also because of, again, going back to those lifeless, chemical-dependent soils, which don't have the healthy ecosystem of microbes or fungi, bacteria, which actually deliver these micronutrients to the plants, which we can then eat. And so I think this amazing book came out by Professor David Montgomery and his wife, Anne Beakley, on what your food ate. I think you interviewed him recently. And I think he synthesized, you know, a lot of the recent research on that. That's still a very new field, an emerging field. We think there's huge potential, though, as we understand the differences between different types of food and how the healthy food is linked to healthy soils and therefore to healthy humans as well. So, I think we've just confirming the original themes, but trying to highlight the new research which has come out on each of those areas.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to see, going back also when we remade the video course and going back to the original white paper you wrote, but also going back to our original video course, we saw that the nutrient density or quality discussion and connection to soil was actually quite present already in your original white paper. I remember seeing what you wrote on why that's the case, why we think it's the case, because there wasn't so much research yet, because it was way before. But when I looked at what interviews we've recorded back then at the time, and now, I mean, we've done two full series on it. We've had Anne and David on, and of course, we had a lot of scientists on as well. So that seems to have really at least moved more into the spotlight. Still not common knowledge. I think we shouldn't expect that everybody read that book, especially people who work in the health sector. And thus, it doesn't necessarily translate to more revenue for farmers or paid for quality or something like that. I think there's a huge gap there to what we now know and what it means on the ground every day for your pistachios, for your almonds and for beef and grain, etc. I mean, there's a huge gap, but I think we're going to see a lot. If you will update this again or write a new one in 4 or 5 years, I think there will be hopefully some examples where we start to connect that and actually have a flow of capital that makes sense for farmers or landowners or investors, et cetera, that can show that their quality is fundamentally different. But I was surprised how little we paid attention to it. We mentioned it was an important module in the first video course we did, but it wasn't, we just didn't have a lot of episodes to refer to because we just didn't have a lot of people to talk to in that. And that has changed significantly over the last couple of years. And another one, do you see that narrative in the biodiversity piece? I don't know. I feel like a number of years ago, but maybe the bubble was just a bit different. There was a lot of discussion of this sparing versus and intensifying and sparing. So if we just intensify the current agriculture system, we can produce more on less land and then leave the rest to nature, whatever that means. That seems to have sort of moved away a bit, or at least be less present. But still, the narrative of combining, having nature and a lot of biodiversity on productive land seems still very far away from many people to grasp that. Do you feel that is a strong narrative that is holding us back because many people simply cannot imagine that there could be biodiversity on a productive farm?
Yeah, I think it's still a pretty hotly contested subject, you know, that land sparing versus land sharing. And I think we've seen it pushed by certain business models as well, for example, the kind of vertical farming or, you know, lab-based meats and more technological, you know, food production systems kind of latch onto that. If you can take land out of agriculture production, that's going to be good for nature. And of course, you
by know, definition, it also says yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
And of course, there's a real value to conserving natural areas, natural habitats that we have left in the planet. But as is our view, we don't want to then just put all our focus on those areas and exclude the majority of land, which is farmed, and whether for crops or for livestock. You know, that is most of the planet. It is affected by human management. And we think there's massive potential there to change how those lands are managed in such a way to increase biodiversity on farms and productive lands. You know, so it's really, I think, both. You know, we conserve the natural habitats we have, but then we don't give up on the productive areas, you know, and we can do things to improve, again, the healthy soil, biologically active soils is the foundation, and that can, and reducing chemical pesticide use can support insects, can support bird life, flora, fauna, and all the way up through the pyramid, you know, the species pyramid. So yeah, we think that a lot more research is required on that, of course, as well, because one thing we've seen, biodiversity is quite hard to measure and report on. It can be very expensive to do it well, and so I think we're still lacking some of the data, I suppose, to really weigh up the impacts and the trade-offs, you know, of these different approaches.
And in your conversations with investors, because you have a lot of them, you have a lot of those conversations, what has changed over the last years? Has it, like, is the interest, How's the tone, let's say, of the conversations changed? And are they actually wiring money? Because the tone can change, but if people are not wiring, we're not getting anywhere. What has shifted? Has something shifted there finally, or are we still very early?
Yeah, well, I think one thing we've seen over the last 2 to 3 years, regenerative agriculture has become a hot topic. You know, everyone's talking about it, whether it's It's farmers, it's food companies, it's governments, or it's investment managers or investors. So there's a huge exposure of interest in the topic. I think that's led to a certain amount of confusion amongst investors because they don't know really what the topic means. You know, so there isn't a commonly accepted definition what is regenerative agriculture. I think also they get even more confused because there's two almost risks I think we see with the current conversation with regenerative agriculture. On the one side, there's going to be a certain amount of hype, like people almost overselling the power of regenerative agriculture, claiming it can address climate change, it can solve all environmental problems, but also it can be, you know, $1 trillion investment opportunity, cetera, producing venture type returns. So I think some of those claims can be a little bit misleading. On the other hand, we see quite a bit of greenwashing where we have, let's say, more conventional producers, farmers, investors, or managers claiming to be regenerative and putting that regenerative label on what they're doing. And in many cases, they're not doing anything different from before. It's still sort of business as usual. All they're changing is how they maybe measure and report on what they're doing. But I think that can weaken, let's say, the term regenerative agriculture. If you know everything has always been regenerative, then why bother trying to change anything? So I have some sympathy for investors who are coming to space for the first time that there's a lack of definition. There's hype on one side, greenwashing the other. And one of the main reasons we wrote the white paper was to help investors navigate through these perilous waters, you know, and get to the other side and understand the potential of regenerative agriculture, but also some of the risks and challenges, you know, and come into it in a very kind of clear-headed, sort of realistic way.
Yeah, no, there's definitely the risk of a lot of large land investors specifically, or land funds that suddenly, like a few years ago, suddenly they put all their SDGs everywhere and they were suddenly also working on water and they were working on this and working on that. And now, of course, funds are being renamed and names pop up left and right. And all they do is maybe be slightly less bad or working on sustainability instead of going through, which is super difficult. Let's not underestimate the shifts, but they cannot all be working on regenerative. Then we'll be at 20, 30, 40% of the land, and that's impossible. And so there, something must be off there.
Yeah. But I think the good news is we have seen a lot more real interest among investors, you know, who have been able to step through this landscape, and people are making commitments, you know, like our, just looking at our business, you know, we started in 2009, you know, as a pretty pure play asset manager focused on regenerative agriculture and forestry. We raised our first fund in Australia in 2012. It took us many, many years, you know, to have hard work to build a business. But I think we're now manage over $580 million, you know, around the world through funds and separate accounts. And we're investing in three continents, in Australia, Europe, and the US. And a lot of that growth has come in the last two or three years. Like, it's been quite exponential, you know.
And do you see that easily doubling again? I mean, I'm not going to ask the $1 billion question, but do you see like a clear path? Like, if you would have the same amount of money, like, in a couple of years, you could put that to work, even though it's not that you put $10 billion to work easily, but a few hundred million more, is there space for that?
Completely, yeah. And I think because we've taken the time to build our implementation capacity in each geography. So we've got people on the ground with connections to farmers who we can identify opportunities. So we kind of build it from the ground up and then try and find the capital to match that. So I think, yeah, the opportunities are there. And we do see continued growth and ability to scale. I think there's increasing investor interest as well. It's driven by two things. So one is, you know, what we do, we focus on real assets and farmland investing. And we're seeing increasing investor interest in real assets as a part of their portfolio. So it's almost a financial motivation. They like the diversification, the lack of correlation of asset class, the income yield, the downside protection, the inflation hedging. So people are making allocations to real assets within that, maybe allocating to farmland and forestry now more than, you know, 10 years ago for sure. So that's
the
one reason.
Got bigger,
but the second is really around impact and commitments that investors are making on around nature, natural capital, climate, biodiversity, and investing in regenerative agriculture is a way in which they could deliver on some of those commitments and help with their reporting and their alignment with sort of global initiatives. So those financial impact motivations, I think, are often where they overlap is where we see a lot of investor interest and the kinds of strategies that we develop.
And is it more institutional or more private, as in family offices? And I mean, they can also become institutional, but let's say the private wealth side or the institutional space, pension funds, yeah, and things like that?
I think it's a mix. I think of the capital we manage, if you add it all up, it's probably 3/4 institutional capital. So we manage money on behalf of large insurance companies, pension funds. And then we also work with a number of family offices as well, from big to small. And so I think there's interest in all those types of investors in this space.
And you mentioned something before, we work from the ground up, and in the current white paper, it was very clear the scarcity of farmers. Like that's big, and we hear that constantly. The amount of landowners I know that would welcome an experienced regen farmer tomorrow on their land, or investors that would love to co-invest with experienced regen farmers, et cetera, that are able to talk investor language, manage large scale estates, et cetera. There's a lot of work for them, let's say. How do you, first of all, how did you identify that from the beginning, and how do you mitigate that?
Yeah. No, I think, That's the other thing we tried to do in this white paper, was to really draw on the lessons that we've learned over the last sort of 10 plus years investing in regenerative agriculture around the world. And I say the number one thing we've learned is the importance of partnering with the right local farmers. And I think we always knew this would be, you know, a key factor, but I think our actual experience on the ground has just emphasized and cemented that, because there aren't, you know, this type of first, I think the first point is farming is a tough business, you know, so farming well at any type is hard, requires a very skilled person.
There are few very successful farmers in general. That's just,
And they need this amazing combination of skills from agronomy to ecology to mechanic to marketer to kind of team leader, CEO,
and branding.
It's an incredible mixture of skills. So finding a good farmer is hard in the first place. But farming regeneratively is particularly hard because it often requires a higher level of knowledge and skills and understanding of the interaction of these ecological, biological processes and how to harness them. So it's an even rarer and more specialized group. And we found it's hard to create those farmers, you know, and to train. I think that, of course, there's a huge need for training. But our business model has focused more and more over time on finding the existing regenerative organic farmers who have done it for a while and who want to scale. And then we try and back them and help them expand. That's the way I think we've been able to de-risk the strategies for our investors. Absolutely, we need training. We need new farmers as well. And we do lots of things to help that indirectly. But it's almost, maybe it's more philanthropic capital and government-backed initiatives that can drive that. And our focus is in helping existing regenerative farmers scale up.
Yeah, and through that, indirectly, you will train the next generation as well. Like, do we need this larger, and some people are going to email me now, but we need this larger professionally run investor backed farms as training ground for a lot more other farmers that are going to run other operations and are going to be investor backed or invested by XYZ, because otherwise, where else can you learn this at scale and with investor communication and which is a very different thing than running your family farm, with all respect, but it's a very different beast if you have investors to communicate with that live very far away and have no clue what you're doing on the land. And so that scarcity, has it become easier to find these farmers in the hubs you're working, or is it a constant challenge? And whenever you find one, you jump on the opportunity to buy the neighbor and help him or her?
I think there is a shift going on within the farming community. There's a much greater openness to these regenerative farming practices and ideas than there was even 10 years ago. You know, if you look, for example, organic farming almost as a subset of regenerative agriculture, like that's an interesting case in point where, you know, organic food sales are now 6% of total food sales. It's a significant part of markets. It's, you know, maybe 20 years ago it was seen as something for, you know, kind of hippies or hobby farmers, environmentalists, but now actually seen as a proper business and real farmers, you know, are actively involved in it. So I think there's definitely great interest in this amongst farmers. They also, because they struggle with high input costs, with prices they can't control, with very, you know, small margins and a lot of risk. And so I think the good farmers are always looking for ways to reduce costs, decommodify the production, you know, and seeking higher margin business lines. And that's where regenerative organic, you know, can maybe deliver that. So, yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely a greater pool to draw from, but it's still not the mainstream, you know, so you still have to be very selective and put a lot of work in to get get on the ground and build relationships and find good farmers to work with.
And then you mentioned something fascinating in the current white paper, the regenerative edge, which for sure is going to be shared widely, and people are going to be very happy that they saw that. Like, can you walk us through what leads to and why you called it the regenerative edge?
Yeah. So I think the white paper, maybe less than half the white paper is more around the science and the impacts and what we've talked about so far. But the other half is very much around the investment case, you know, and trying to show that regenerative farming can be economically better for the farmer, but also for investors who support, you know, that farmer. And I think there's a number of ways that those higher returns or higher, better economics can be achieved. The number of levers that you can pull, you know, on the one hand, it can be through higher yields. And we certainly see that in certain cases where you're increasing production on the land through your regenerative practices.
Oh, now I have to interrupt you. Like, we're not all going to starve when we move to regenerative agriculture. Sorry, man. The narrative is very interesting here, because the yield is like, we're recording this as farmers are protesting in all over Europe and other places. Like, let's interrupt. Okay, we're going to come back to the investment case, but the yield, you say a very interesting line as well. There's no single story on yield. Let's unpack that a bit, and then we're going to come back to the investment case. So when investors, because I'm just playing devil's advocate here, say, yeah, but what about yield? What do you normally answer to them? I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah. And in this paper, I think we do take quite a nuanced approach. You know, I think it's all context specific. It depends on local ecosystems, local markets, what you are growing, and the practices that you're using. So there isn't a single story here. There's absolutely examples of regenerative farming practices which improve soil health, improve soil organic matter, lead to higher yields. So there's plenty of case studies there around the world of that. We see in particular in grazing systems, actually livestock, pasture-raised livestock systems, by using types of rotational grazing, dividing land up into smaller fields, using fencing, water points, and managed grazing, you can increase carrying capacity, so carry more animals on the same grass.
By significant amounts, we've seen.
By significant amount, yeah. And we've seen increases of up to 50% plus carrying capacity increases.
And even
the same
anecdotally,
land.
I've heard way more as well, which we need more research to go into. But that's realizing that that's possible. How far we can push it is a second, but that's possible without a lot of inputs, or potentially without any inputs, and restoring pasture land and all the biodiversity stuff that comes with this. Yep. We've seen fascinating research coming out of that, plus the carbon piece, which is being researched often, but even just the carrying capacity goes up, which means more calories per hectare, acre, whatever you're measuring.
Exactly. And it takes maybe some capital expenditure, some CapEx, you know, and infrastructure, but the actual input costs are extremely low. We think it's great potential in grazing systems. I think though, when it comes to other regenerative farming systems, such as organic, it isn't always the case. You know, we do see some slightly Panglossian claims that, you know, organic farming has the same yields. And there are some crops where yields can get pretty close. So alfalfa, olives, for example, we have seen organic yields being similar to conventional. But, you know, if you look at the mainstream, the traditional grain crops and many orchard crops, yields are lower. You know, we see that. We invest heavily in organic grains in the U.S. Midwest. And we typically see yield gaps of 15 to 20%, maybe 25% on corn, soybeans, wheat, you know, depending on the exact system and the farmer's sort of approach. So there are yield gaps, you know, for many organic systems. So it's not one answer in yield. So definitely some opportunities to improve. Other maybe yields might be the same. Others, they might go down. But I think with intermittent regenerative agriculture, in a way, that doesn't matter. I mean, that's not the farmer's goal. And one of the issues, or one of the reasons regenerative agriculture has emerged, is almost a reaction against that productivist mindset, which dominated agriculture for so long, where farmers are being told to just maximize yield per hectare.
Only thing that matters
at
is
any cost,
whatever you do.
And pump in inputs and get the most yield, and you could hold your head up high at the farmer conference because you won that year's yield record. Yeah, bushels per acre. Whereas actually, I think the regenerative farmers are realizing it's not about yield per hectare, it's about profit per hectare. And so they're looking to optimize yield rather than to maximize yield, which gets you to the other levers. And I think the second key lever we see for regenerative edge on the economic side is around costs, like trying to reduce input costs. And that's a massive concern. As we know, farmers faced, you know, doubling or tripling of fertilizer prices over the last couple of years because of the situation, Russian invasion of Ukraine. We've seen spikes in fuel prices. We've seen increases in agrochemical costs. So these costs
and
are a massive part
of
the budget.
Like there's no, I mean, maybe a bit, et cetera, but there's, once they go up, well, it's very, like fuel prices are very difficult to push down. And agrochemicals is not that suddenly the companies are like, yeah, oh, let's give some discounts left and right.
They have come down quite a bit, just like, to be fair, over the last couple of years. The fertilizer people are down. So then there's cyclical markets. But we do tend to see a certain stickiness, in particular in things like seeds and chemicals, more branded products, where, you know, often it's hard for the farmers to get the benefits of the downturns in the cycles. They always seem to be struggling with the upticks in pricing.
Yeah, but so reducing input costs, easier, like fertilizer, fuels, they tend to be more connected to a global price. But yeah, branded seeds just are not so global and will stick upwards. Yeah.
So if you can reduce your use of chemical fertilizers, of pesticides, of GMO seeds, and instead you can use compost, manures, grow cover crops, grow your fertility, you know, do integrated pest management and reduce those input costs, that can make a big input on a big impact on profits. A third thing we see, though, a lever is around premium pricing. You know, can you actually achieve a better pricing for product by selling to premium markets? Again, organic is the most developed example of that, where, as I mentioned before, organic food markets are large, especially in Europe and USA. They're growing strongly. There is a strong consumer awareness of organic certification, a willingness to pay a premium. And there's some very strong premiums being delivered back to farmers at the farm gate. It depends on product. And we have a chart in the white paper where you might see US corn selling for an 80% premium for organics. US blueberries are now more like a 0% premium because there's been oversupplied. So each market has its own supply demand dynamics.
That's massive. Like even if you have a 10, 15, 20% yield drop, which might slowly close, or some years you're actually better. I mean, that doesn't mean it's a permanent one. You have massively lower costs over years or even same costs and you get a premium of 80%. That's going to change your year quite significantly.
Yeah, and there's some research just came out from University of Illinois, actually, looking at the predicted farm budgets for corn, soybean growers in Illinois over 2024. And they're predicting that average conventional growers will lose money per acre. Whereas when we look at our organic farmers, their budgets, you know, they're making, you know, probably $400 or $500 per acre profit, you know, versus a loss on the conventional side. So there's a stark difference at the moment. With current organic versus conventional pricing. Yeah. So that's another reason for the edge, is that those higher product prices. I think a fourth though lever, which is developing quite quickly, we see around the world, is around payments for ecosystem services. In particular, carbon is the most developed, but maybe we'll see it for biodiversity and water impacts as well. But if a farmer can have all these, create these environmental outcomes around soil health and carbon, biodiversity, water, and as you get paid for it in the form of credits or offsets or some other payments, that's an extra revenue line in the farmer's
P&L. Yeah, which is 1-2%, I think, you like the extra payments you're envisioning. Has that happened outside Australia yet? Because you clearly mentioned Australia's leading the way here. Have you seen that with being active in three continents? Have you been paid for any environmental services beyond Australia?
Yeah, we're working on a North America, Europe, and Australia. I will say Australia, we always say, is about 10 years ahead, you know, where I think we've sold over 1.7 million tons of CO2 credits in Australia and generated over 20 million Australian dollars in revenues over the last 5 years. So it's a serious part of our business down there. In the US, we just did a pilot project in the US Midwest, looking at the carbon impacts of converting conventional cropland to organic certification. And within the first year, I think we generated, I think about 1,500 credits, you know, from those farms. So that was a pilot project, which is just, we're just finishing up the results of that now. So we're just beginning to implement those systems in the US, and we're now working on a similar approach with our orchard farms, actually in Spain
with
and Portugal.
Farmers,
we're working
right?
with climate farmers, to develop new methodologies and potentially generate credits, probably more 2025 onwards. So
this is not really there yet, right? For orchards, like both the tree carbon and the soil carbon, I've yet to see, interestingly enough, work on that, like in terms of carbon credits. It's much more, I just haven't seen that, I think, for perennial crops until now.
Yeah, it's been more neglected, and what we looked all around, and you know, we didn't really see the methodologies and the schemes in place, which is why we're partnering with Climate Farmers and we're co-funding with them the development of new methodologies, which are relevant to Mediterranean orchard crops. I think there's also a rationale, there's an explanation for that. Your bang for your buck is going to be lower on sort of high value orchards. You know, like if you can store, I don't know, 2 to 5 tons of CO2 per hectare on an orchard, which might be worth, you know, 50,000 euros per hectare, and you sell your credits, maybe you're getting 20 euros, 30 euros per ton. Like maybe you're getting 100 euros per hectare of extra revenue. It's a nice thing, but it's not going to move the needle that much. If you can achieve, you know, 1 or 2 tons per hectare on land that's, you know, extensive wheat land, for example, in the high plains of the US, which is worth maybe, you know, $3,000 a hectare, it can produce much more significant income yield. So I think that's where we see the biggest lever, let's say, in returns is probably more in grazing land, more extensive cropping land. And as you get to higher value irrigated orchard type land, the impact returns is lower. But we do still think it's very important because it helps you measure and report your impact, you know, because you're getting rigorous third-party verified carbon accounting effectively, which is important for other reasons as well.
And like it seems, especially the last few years, like the climate weirding is really getting weird. Like how much are investors holding back, or is that a part of their rationale to maybe not invest in agriculture at all, simply because it seems all difficult, even though maybe regen offers an edge or an hedge, sorry, to that? Like how much is the climate weirding part of your conversations or not so much? Because we see it constantly too warm, constantly too cold, constantly too wet, too dry, too, like every summer or every wherever you live seems to be extreme at the moment. And that was in 2016, didn't feel like that yet. Like it's definitely speeding up. Is that something you hear from the investor side?
Yeah, I think we do. We increasingly get that question. I think you have to separate between weather and climate. You know, so farming has always been a weather dependent business, and there's wet spells, there's dry spells, there's cyclicality and variability.
So you're used to one in inevitable. Australia, I remember you invested, and I think you went to do the worst dry spell ever recorded for the first, I don't remember how many years of the fund.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
So this is not new, you're saying. Yeah.
But I think what investors are increasingly cautious about, and we are too, is those long-term changes in that weather through climate change. So I think it's something we put a lot more effort into now than ever before. Whenever we develop a new strategy, is that it's a top-down climate analysis, looking at the climate change models, looking at predictions, precipitation, rainfall, temperature. It's particularly important with some of these orchard crops. If you're planting an orchard for 20, 30 years and your almonds might need a particular number of chilling hours, or, you know, there's a frost risk. So yeah, doing that climate analysis is really one of the starting points now for all our strategies, and be able to show that that region you're investing in, that crop or system you're investing in, is going to be have at least a neutral or positive climate skew, you know, with climate change. But I think the other thing, and this is going back to those levers of return to regenerative edge, is using regenerative agriculture to increase resilience on farm, you know, because if you can have healthier soils with more organic matter, storing water in the dry spells, absorbing water in the floods, it's going to help with the resilience and take us on the variability of production. And you've covered this a lot in your podcast over the years, but it's that risk mitigation resilience that comes from regenerative agriculture. Can take out some of that maybe fluctuations in profitability. So you put it all together, just going back to in terms of numbers, this regenerative edge.
Yeah, what's the regen edge? People are waiting. I didn't come back to it.
We see that, that regenerative approach can maybe add like 1% to 3% to an IRR. That's typically what we see at the farm level. We're investing in real assets in the farm itself, depending on kind of where you are and what system you're investing in. So it's certainly, it's a very attractive, let's say, extra return that investors can get by backing these regenerative systems.
Again, really peaking the context, location, farm, farmer, and crop really market really, really, really well. Because otherwise, I've also heard stories of investors saying they did, and landowners are saying they did all kinds of regenerative things, and basically left everything to, like, went cold turkey with chemicals, left everything bit by themselves to develop, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then complained it didn't work, whatever it was, regen didn't work. I'm like, yeah, that's going to hurt the story for a bit, or that's going to, because it's very intense. Like management is knowledge management and management of the land is very intense in any transition, and we should not underestimate that. But 1-3% is significant in real asset strategies to be achieved. And if you look at the portfolio now, or things you're looking at without revealing too much, like what part of the regenerative agriculture sphere excites you the most at the moment? Probably not blueberries, but what is like, it's like, ooh, that's actually very, very exciting. Is it the grain side, the animal side? We'll get to animals because you cover quite a bit in the white paper, but or the orchard side of things?
Yeah, so a couple of areas we're working on now. So one is looking to invest in mixed farming systems in Australia, where we can also start carbon projects. I think that's quite exciting because Australia is,
yeah, shout out to Baird,
is very advanced when it comes to integrating livestock and cropping. And that's something which we've sort of forgotten how to do in the US and many other parts of the world. But Australian farmers have a long tradition of integrating grazing into cropping systems, and you can get some great benefits for weed control and nutrient recycling and really regenerative impacts. But also we see some big potential soil carbon increases and how you manage such perennial pastures within those systems. And the Australian carbon market is very developed now. So we feel we can underwrite generation sale of credits such that it can be, again, add that 2-3% maybe to the return from those strategies. So that's something we're launching now and developing with our local partner, Impact Ag. So that's something that's big focus for the next couple of years.
And what kind of system would it be? Like permanent pasture with row crops in it, permanent pasture with perennials? Like how do you see that?
So we just bought a large farm in New South Wales, which has, I think it's about over 3,500 hectares, and it's about a third dryland cropping, a third perennial pasture, a third more native vegetation. So you're getting these sort of mixed landscapes, and you can use the animals, they're grazing the perennial pasture, but also rotating through those cropping zones as well, to get the beneficial impacts on the cropping part of the business as well. So it's optimizing that landscape use.
And sorry, beyond that, you were continuing, yeah.
Yeah, I think the other thing, we are doing a lot of work on orchard systems, both in California, on the west coast of the US, but also in Spain and Portugal. And we do think that, as the point you made earlier, that regenerative agriculture has sort of overlooked a little bit the orchard systems. There's been more focus on annual cropping, arable systems, or in livestock systems. But we do think there's great potential in orchards, even quite commercial intensive orchards, to take away some of the negative impacts of the high chemical use and soil degradation, and instead use cover crops and compost and minimal till, and even integrating livestock grazing and whole orchard recycling, a whole bunch of practices that can really improve soil health, change the carbon footprint quite a bit of those orchards, and also potentially allow you to go fully organic, where you can attract some of those premiums. So that's something we're actively working on in Europe and the US.
And then as a final piece, or whatever we go to, but let's tackle the livestock piece, because you have quite a significant sort of chapter or module in the white paper on livestock. I think in the last 7-8 years since the last one came out, livestock has been intensely debated on all sides. We've seen a whole hype cycle, I think, of lab-grown, plant-based, which of course not the same, meat, which seems to deflate, collapse now a bit. You for sure had to explain 100,000 times why you invest in livestock as an impact investor. So what made you put livestock so significantly, in the white paper now?
Yeah, it's a question we get all the time, from investors and others. And so we wanted to step back a bit and almost explain what's the case for well-managed pasture-raised livestock, and how they can have very positive impacts. And I think, it's a very highly contested area within the scientific community, because since we wrote our first white paper in 2016, there were then a number of very critical reports sort of painting livestock, in particular cattle, as sort of environmental villains because of the methane and other emissions associated with them. But I think there has been a bit of a swinging back of the pendulum, as other reports now recently have come out, trying to understand the impacts of livestock within a system, looking at the ability to store carbon in soils to offset some of those emissions, but also the ability of livestock to use areas of land we can't use for anything else. They can consume grasses, which humans cannot, and turn into a very healthy, nutritious product. And so they allow us to to make use of areas of land which can actually help conserve, you could say, other natural areas. You know, so there and there's a food security angle, there's a human culture angle there as well. So we wanted to step back, and I think our view is that you know, well managed livestock on pasture, there's quite a few examples now where the soil carbon sequestration impacts can be very substantial and can go a long way towards changing
that carbon research footprint. Coming out of the US, which is very substantial.
Questions, of course, around does that apply to every ecosystem?
Permanent,
of course, not the same way. Would do soils get saturated over time? Does that effect wear off? Lots of open questions, but our view is we think we're only starting as well to kind of touch the surface of research on this. You know, so as these case studies get fully explored and synthesized, I think we'll see a bit of a shift where people do recognize that soil carbon storage can go a long way towards offsetting some of those methane emissions. And then I think it's looking at livestock and assistance point of view. There's some great research came out of France recently where they actually model out a different European food system, which is effectively quasi-organic, you know, so taking out of nitrogen fertilizer, a lot of chemicals, using very organic regenerative systems. What would that food system look like? And they also, I think, spared 10% of farmland for afforestation, so taking land out of production. Their conclusion was you'd have a lot less cereals, and because of that, you'd have a lot less pigs and chickens, so monogastric animals. You'd have actually the same amount of cattle, because the cattle can make use of those natural grasslands and perennial pastures, which aren't used for anything else. Yeah. And you can integrate it into cropping systems and get to nutrition and weed control benefits. So a truly regenerative system, in our view, actually really benefits some livestock. So we don't think they're environmental villains. You know, it's a kind of trite phrase. It's the how, not the cow. And we think you have to look at it in a slightly more systems perspective to really understand the impacts.
Yeah, and I think there's a piece on the methane as well, which, as far as I understand, all the research, especially the super negative ones, obviously has been based on models and has been based on CAFO operations where to be measured to a certain extent. Of course, fed grain and cereals and things like that. And the few things where we've seen it, I discussed it with Bert Glover as well a few years back, like to actually research it on farm, on a healthy pasture, to see the amount of methane a cow actually emits is very difficult and hasn't been done many cases. So the methane we see in those charts might be from a CAFO operation instead of from a healthy pasture. So maybe the methane is less or is different or has a different role there. So both sides have to be researched, both the carbon side and the actual methane side. But it seems... Yeah, it seems that the narrative is shifting slightly, but still it's very strong, especially our world in data, always that fancy graph where beef is like all the way outside the screen and the rest is you can better eat almonds and things like that, which are very healthy. But the research is not just not show that it's outdated LCAs that shouldn't be used for that. And then another one you mentioned, I think in two lines or something in the white paper on vertical farms and other things that, let's say, have hyped over the last 7-8 years. What do you see there? Because you probably have to compete sometimes, at least for the investor attention, because they fall in the same bucket as food and ag, but completely different, of course. Like, what's your normal go-to answer when investors says, why should I just not invest in vertical farm XYZ compared to something so complicated and far away in Australia?
Yeah. I think they're fundamentally different asset classes. You know, if you're investing in farmland, you know, and appreciating natural asset is fundamentally different from investing in effectively a factory, you know, a food factory in steel and machinery, which depreciates over time. So, you know, that's more of a private equity, you could say, strategy. So it could be a different risk return profiles. That's the first thing. I think the second is, you know, what's the scalability of some of those models and there's certainly some successful vertical farming models growing high value leafy greens, tomatoes, you know, very specialized crops where people willing to pay a premium for closeness to market and freshness. But I've seen no evidence that it can ever scale to grow staple food crops, you know, they're going to feed the world. So it's a niche specialized business, you know, but I think it has been overhyped, and I think we've seen the same with some of the plant-based meat products. We've seen the same with lab-based meat. So I think there's a strange blurred line where you know, marketing latches onto science and selectively uses science to essentially to create a narrative around a business model. And I think that can catch on, the media cover it, and everyone gets on that bandwagon for a while. And it takes a little bit of time for reality to sort of kick back in and people to realize that maybe some of those claims were overdone. I think we've seen that in some of those more techie sectors over the last few years.
Yeah, and talking about technology, there's this narrative which we try to dispel, of course, constantly, but this regenerative agriculture is anti-science and anti-technology. Like, it's going back to whatever that we probably don't want to go back to, plowing the field by hand. What do you, when you see that sort of look on an investor's face that they think, oh, this is hippie stuff, what do you normally say? Or what do you get them on the farm? Or do you, like, what do you, how do you counter that narrative of this is anti-science and anti-technology and nice for hippies in a backyard?
Yeah, well, we certainly tackle that in the white paper, because like we would strongly make the claim that regenerative agriculture is based on the most advanced science, like all the pioneering discoveries in ag science over the last few years have all been around biology, you know, the role of healthy soils and biologically active soils and how they can support productive farming systems. That's where all the advances have been taking place. You know, it's how do we wean ourselves off the chemicals and use biology instead? And we even talk in a bigger picture, if you look at the like over hundreds of years, I think you can obviously see three different agriculture revolutions. You know, the first revolution agriculture in the 19th century was around mechanization. So bigger tractors, reapers, harvesters, allowing farmers to farm big areas. The next phase, really the 20th century, was around chemicals. You know, so using synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, agrochemicals, pesticides, and then certain seeds which could make use of those high inputs to grow more yield, you know, per hectare. But I think the third revolution, which is starting to happen now, is a shift towards biology. You know, understanding how these biological systems work and how soils function, and then harnessing the biological ecological process to build good farming systems. So I think we're seeing it on the ground with farmers. We're seeing it with actually lots of startup companies too, working biologicals and, you know, fertilizers, stimulants, seed coating. So that's, I think, where all the activity is. And regenerative agriculture is building on that, building on that science. So that's the first thing we always say. I think the second around, absolutely right, around labor and the role of, you know, mechanization and technology. The other big challenge that all farmers and farming systems have is attracting labor, you know, finding people to work on the land. It's getting harder and harder. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because people don't want to do menial, backbreaking sort of peasant type labor in the fields anymore if they can avoid it. And so I think we see increasing need for clever use of machines and technology, robotics, you know, robotic weeders. We may experiment with a self-driving electric tractor in our orchards in California to mow the cover crops so we don't need to spray herbicides. You know, so they can be very consistent, we think, with, again, biological regenerative systems, where you're, again, taking out the chemicals and using machines, technology, robots for mechanical and other control of pests and disease and weeds.
And do you then see investors click on that? Or it depends, obviously, but is that an easily overcomable, let's say, narrative to get people on board that this is actually modern agriculture and not tradition or like not going back to?
Yeah, I think if you get investors out on farm and they see that these are scaled up commercial operations,
real farms, yeah,
farmers with, you know, like healthy balance sheets with millions of dollars in assets or euros in assets and employing, you know, people and in business and growing, I think, you know, they see that these are real proper businesses. So I do think the evidence is there. Like, this isn't just sort of 1 hectare hobby plots, you know, in someone's backyard. These are proper commercial farms applying these ideas, you know, on a big scale.
And do you do that a lot, like getting investors out there?
We try. We always invite and always welcome investors to come. It can be hard, you know, they're busy, they have limited budgets. So, but I find it makes a huge difference if you can get people out on farm for a day or two. Everything tends to click, you know, after that much more quickly.
Yeah, the conversion, I think, goes up significantly. I heard somebody, who was it? Probably an interview that just went out actually as we were talking on Agroforestry Partners. Like almost every investor that visited, of course the sample size might be small, but almost everybody that visited ended up investing. And the selection criteria is of course also there. You only go if you're pretty sure you're going to do something, but still it's very strong because most people, let's not forget, are in New York, London, Amsterdam, Delhi, Shanghai, wherever in financial centers. Let's say their exposure to farmland is very limited. And learning through white papers is great, but getting out there is a whole different experience. And they're examples everywhere you can visit. Like it's not impossible to find something a couple of hours travel from where you are to see at least something relatively scalable with a lot of interesting practices applied. So I think that is a perfect way to wrap this interview up or this conversation up. I want to thank you so much for rewriting the white paper or completely redoing that and publishing. I know I've been annoying you for a long time. When is the new one coming? When is the new one coming? For sure, many others have done the same. So thank you for that. This is definitely a huge asset. I can't remember how many times I shared the previous one. So now I have to update my links. We'll make sure to spread this as wide and far as possible. So thank you, Paul, so much for joining us here, for sharing, and for all the hard work on the land, investing, and of course, writing this white paper.
Yeah, no, thanks, Ken, and thanks for publicizing the last paper. And I think it was partly your nagging over the last 2 or 3 years was prompted us to write the next one. So let us know when you think the third chapter is required.
I won't do it for a couple of years, don't worry.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.